What I sent you out is probably the most, certainly the most extensive that I'm aware of, maybe one, I don't want to say it's the most significant, but an extremely significant archaeological discovery that was made, I think, in the 1900s or so, in the 1860s. He describes, it was 1868, okay. And then it was subsequently looted by the French and taken to the Louvre in Paris. I'm sorry, it was just as it was taken, but this, of course, is stolen property. It meant in... I presume that they were transporting it one way or the other to hide it, to take it, to bring it, and it broke. You can study the... I don't know what the circumstances were. I'm sure if you go back to... The French or German journals of that time of archaeology, whatever, you might find a discussion of the story. Okay, so anyway, it's also important, at least from our perspective, let me ask the following question. Does it concur with the biblical account? Does it differ with the biblical account? Or do they sort of not talk about the same things, even though they do discuss the same figures? Aaron?
I think it's similar, you know, the same kings, names, and also the fact that they all got war with each other.
Right.
Certain details are...
Okay, so certain of the details seem a little different. Maybe, I'm not convinced. Yeah?
I didn't actually know the details were skewed. What I was looking in the very demo, were very vague about it. It says that...
I know exactly what you're speaking about. Right. Very good. Okay. In other words, when you read the account carefully, yeah, and I'll take your other comments, David.
I didn't see them disagreeing at all. Simply because they could be talking about before and after.
They could be.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think that's what Alan was saying. Right. In other words, the Tanakh is before, and then you're getting the after. So you are. Your name? Oh, okay. I thought you were...
Yeah, right.
I'm getting there. Okay. So, and I think that's the same thing. The Tanakh is before, Mishnah is after. And something happens in those last two psukim, which suggests, okay, well, things didn't go so well. And that's a great pasuk for a couple of reasons. The question is, whose son did he slaughter? Did he take his own son and slaughter to, if you want to take it sort of a midrashic reading, he took his own son, slaughtered it to his gods, and that reminded the Rabbeinu Shalom of what the Jews had been doing. Okay, that's very midrashic. Alternatively, at least two other interpretations. Anyone know what they were? Yeah?
No, I was telling other people what it actually meant. And it could have been that in the Ketubot Meshah, it says that his son gathered up into, I don't know how many people, 700 or 200 people, and went out to war and killed all these Jewish people. But it could have been...
Was that his son or was that him?
Was it 200 men at the law?
No, it was
I took
one. Yeah. No. It's him. Mesha's writing it. Yeah, his father was the one who lost, you know, who really got beaten back badly. That's interesting. What happened in the story in the Nabi's account? What did he do?
I just want to point out one thing.
Yeah. It's not a bad har. The only thing to remember is that the stone is somewhat fragmentary, let me put it this way. I mean, it's mostly intact, but I would say that what is significant account on our event, on our account, might not have been their eyes. Now, for us, the notion of human sacrifice, which is important to our tradition, was common in the world, in the ancient world. But again, in other words, you have a certain ethos, you know, that Jews have had probably for a long time.
It seems like this is what turned the war in his favor, and that would be true.
Okay, but the question is, you're leaning to me, very good point I would have waited to make, but to the extent that I don't think the accounts really differ, but clearly they have different foci. Right? They focus on different things. Why is that? So the, yeah.
Is from Malachim is our account, is Israelite account, and this thing is his account.
Okay, so that's a very, I want to say, non-formal approach to say, well, it's basically whose spin is it? Okay, but I don't think it, as you say, our account isn't their account, but I think it's more than that. I think if this were a secular account, you know, of if Malachim were a secular book, then you'd be right. Then you'd say, you know, whose spin are you, you know, and what do you choose to focus on? But I think there's more than that, a very important point that should be made. Yeah, Aaron?
Just another point. I don't necessarily think the accounts are completely similar. And that is your beginning of Mesha's discussion. He was saying that that Ahav's father conquered a lot from his father, but even during Ahav's time, Mesha already conquered a lot back. It doesn't seem consistent with the Navi's account of Mesha paying taxes.
Why? What's the answer? He rebelled during. In other words, he was a point, and then he rebelled.
But like the Navi, he rebelled after Ahab's death, not before.
Yeah, I know, but Ahab is.
That also
seems. But where do you see Ahab in here? Where do you see Ahab in here?
Yes. Only after the land of Israel has dwelt there in his time. He has to plant his other son Ahab 4 years, but Chemosh dwelt there in my time. So my time would refer to Mesha, and that would still be during the time.
Yeah, but here's one question. How long did Ahab reign?
Yeah.
What?
4 years,
no? Really?
Nah. 22?
Yeah, I think 22 is right. Okay. I think the use of son here, 1 second, I'll tell you where it is. I'm just about looking. Now I'm looking at this. It's going to be end of Malachim Aleph Chafeis. Chafeis. That's right. Chafeis, the second one. Maybe much earlier. Malachim. It doesn't mention at the time of his death. I think Ahav reigned 20 plus years. Esrimushdayim Shana in Malachim Aleph Tezayin.
Okay.
Right, so the point. So, and his father reigned even much shorter than that. So the point is, when he talks about his son, I suspect he means his descendant. He's talking about one generation later.
Well, yeah, I did. I'm going to make this.
I understand. So, but in other words, so I think in general we talk about son. Right, it doesn't have to be literally taken as son. You know, son means descendant of. We talk about, we in our liturgy use the expression Mashiach ben David. Right? So I think in this...
He said, I am the son of Kemosh, and I'm going to read the English thing. Kemosh Billy is God, not his father.
No, it may have been his father's name also. In other words, it wouldn't surprise you. You know, kings, divinities. We don't know from the Navi. This is the only evidence we have, the only information we have, as far as I know, about Mesha, is the Navi and the inscription. Okay, so I think that, so I want to come back to a previous point, though, in terms of, yes, Ezra's comment about, you know, who's writing it matters, but I think there's another angle, which is the fact that it's a Navi, yeah, Jeremy? Well, I don't want to prove a point, but it's theological history. But it's theological history, meaning it's very selective. And the fact that the Torah, the Navi is perhaps not interested in focusing necessarily on military. You leave a story. When you walk through that story, do you think about the battle? What do you think about? What's central in the story? The miracle. Right? The miracle. The rest of it is sort of peripheral. The military. And Mesha is clearly obsessed with the military tactics, right? How he broke through a particular line, took X hundred men. That's not what the Navi's interest is in this case. The Navi's interest is in theological issues, Elisha's miracles, and perhaps whatever that statement is at the end. Now, I want to coming back to, and therefore you might expect the account, you don't expect them to factually differ. That is not a problem, but that raises interesting questions. But you might expect the focus to be different. Now, before I raise the final point at the final issue of why the inscription is so important, what does he do at the end in the Navi's account? It took his Benoha Bukhar Shayim Loch Tachtav. So the question is, what was he doing there? So there are really two possibilities when you discount Chazal. And what are they? Any suggestions?
Yeah.
So that's the Midrashic idea. Let's put that aside. He shechted Melech Edom's son. And why did he have Melech Edom's son? Because he had him as a hostage. You had such a practice, you know. You would talk about habit keeping and the way powerful states used to keep their vassal states in check. One of the ways they did it was Asher, going back to the comment earlier, is you keep their sons as prisoner, right? And if they misbehave, well, then you slaughter their sons. So that's one possibility. The second possibility, yeah. No, so it may have been this is Edom was even less so. And Edom took till later in order to. I mean, Edom rebelled against Yehuda, so you don't know, what the circumstances were. But that's a. But okay, but you're correct. Moab was certainly not the most powerful state. Okay, I mean, we could talk about the geopolitical issues there. The fact that Ahaziah, who was it, Yoram ben Ahab, turned to Melech Yehuda, and you notice Melech Edom just sort of appears out of nowhere. If you read the story really carefully, you know, with the discussion of Melech Yehuda and Melech Yisrael, Edom was a vassal state to Yehuda until after Yehoshaphat's death. And this could have something to do with it also, if it was Melech Edom's son. So, we'll step back for 1 second. And why would that be important in the story? Why would sacrificing Melech Edom's son make a difference? Well, the answer is when the king of Edom went to fight, once he saw that, he withdrew. Okay, so that sort of cut out a large chunk of the army. What's that? Vayisume Allah, right, right. That would be that. What's the other reading? Yeah.
On the other hand, if we're saying that he was so weak,
who was so weak?
Edom. So he was dropping out, when it mattered so much.
No, so clearly the fact that they took Melech Edom along meant that he added something. Right? So, again, we don't know enough, you know, Pratim, we're not given enough to make any kind of judgment. Look, Amesha, notice, also doesn't mention in this context Melech Yehuda or Melech Edom. In other words, that may be a later, that would fit in the fact that it's a later stage, you know, at a point where Melech Yehuda and Melech Yisrael were no longer necessarily getting along as well. Keep in mind what glued Melech Yehuda and Melech Yisrael together at this point, considering that through much of the history they fought or sporadically fought. Theoretically, you've all learned Nevi'im Rishonim in your yeshiva education. For those, so most of you had a yeshiva education, not all of you. But so therefore, I assume that you know it. But I realize, obviously, that most of you don't remember what you when you learn Nevi'im. And but there's something that joined them together. Yeah, there was intermarriage there, right? I think that that one of the kings of Judah, I forget which one, I think it was Ahaziah, married Ahab's daughter. So there was really a familial connection. That's why they could call upon each other. Throughout most of the rest of the history, before Ahab and afterwards, you know, when we hear about anything going on between Yehuda and Yisrael, it's war. It's not, you know, will you join me in war against? So anyway, so it's not surprising at a later stage, towards the end of the dynasty, so Mesha may be fighting only against Melech Yisrael. Yeah, we don't have enough details. Now there is just another possibility, assuming it was the king of Moab's son, and so just from a military perspective, is that he sacrificed it to his own god with the hopes of appeasing his god. But of course, the effect is not, and this is recorded by the Torah, by the Navi, the effect was not, so why exactly was there Kethef and did they the armies withdraw? Because if you want to stir up your fighters, sometimes you do something unusual and you inspire them. Right? Magic may have no efficacy, but if someone believes it does, it can sometimes work anyway. So that may be what's going on. Not entirely clear. Now, why is the Mesha inscription? Yes, question.
Yes, a lot of responsibility. The pronouns used in the second last second, they don't seem to suggest that was a son, because it's just merely his son.
So I understand, but the question is, if he sacrifices his own son, what is the Navi telling us? Okay, that's fine. So some of you raised that, I assume you looked in Radas, or some of the Rishonim, I don't know which, it's been a long time since I looked at them, state and give such an interpretation. Aaron? No, I assume he had one of his... Oh no, I think it's assumed that it was written in Mesha's time. Right? Now, that is an assumption. It's a good question, but I think that's a fair assumption. Right? In other words, look, you expect him to take certain liberties anyway. In other words, his son is not even a liberty, he could mean his grandson or whatever. Okay. Now why is this fine so significant? It's funny, in fact, I remember the one time I was in the Louvre in France, good many years ago, almost a decade ago. So I knew to be looking for the Mesha inscription. And one of the problems, and I assume it hasn't changed in the last 10 years with that museum, I mean, it's mostly looted artifacts. Standards of the world have changed. I'm reminded of the cartoon that my father has hanging on his bulletin board. This is post the accords were, Begin and Sadat, where you see Begin lecturing Carter, and you see sort of showing which parts of the United States are going back, you know, to which country and to the Indians and so on. So I don't say that's a political statement, but it's certainly a reality that rules of the world have changed. Whether that matters or not is a separate question. So you still have occasionally fights over certain artifacts that were taken, and some countries want them back, but they weren't countries in a certain sense when they were taken. So you go in there, a lot of the stuff is legitimate too, but it's overstuffed with stuff. It's all so close together. And so it's very hard to go through the museum. You know, it's like, what do you look at, what do you don't? And then you think that something like the Mayan inscription, which is probably, you know, I don't know, one of the most important finds in biblical archaeology, you'd think that it would be somewhat marked. But you literally, you know, you could walk right past it and realize nothing about it, you know, if you didn't know to be looking for it. But it's very significant for the following reason. We have chosen not to engage in this issue. Future courses might have some stuff to read about, real stuff about archaeology. But, you know, there are different schools of thought among academic scholars. There is a school of minimalists. I think from an intellectual perspective, even if one is not an Orthodox Jew, they're off the walls. But it's a very popular kind of postmodern nihilism, who basically would seek to deny all the biblical events and would see that basically the Bible is a product of Bayesheni Jews, and nothing can be trusted. It's almost like it's all soon to be false until proven otherwise, which of course is absurd to start with. But the truth is that when you find things like the Mayan inscription, it's not the only one, far from the only one. But this is actually rather detailed. You start to realize, hey, one second, at least where we can speak about parallel events, in fact, they are confirmed by the biblical. They basically, in fact, confirm the biblical account, more or less. That not the biblical account in the sense of the details, but the fact that there was a King Mesha and there was a King Omri and so on and so forth. I mean, these are the same people when they, you know, found the Ben David's inscription from the 9th century, wanted to say that, nah, it really wasn't, there was no Davidic house. Or if there was a David, he was like a little two-bit king, you know, had a few towns or something like that. So it's absurd, but the Mesha inscription has to be something that stands out as being a solid piece of corroborative evidence. So we may not need it, but in the field of biblical scholarship with this type of a challenge, it's actually rather interesting. So that's the Mesha inscription. As I said again, for those who came in late, for next week, please make sure you go through these. It's a lot more fun, I think, when you've actually prepared than when you haven't. Make sure you've gone through the laws, pick out three and write a couple of sentences about each of them as to what strikes you about the laws. Presumably what's going to strike you about them is that some of them look like laws in the Torah. So take a look at that. Okay. Anyway. What else would you like it to tell us? I don't know much about the language, the Moabite language, but I assume it's relatively close to Hebrew. But that's tremendously significant. I mean, considering the other than that, you know, what else is one stone with 30 lines going to have great significance, right? It doesn't tell us anything we theoretically didn't know before. It does tell us because it tells us about a post Ahav period. But that is pretty significant. You don't find these things every day. They're not very common. Yeah. I'm sorry? A rank? Are you asking me where do you see that? Don't ask me that. I'll next week. There were classes. There were classes. There were slaves. Well, I'm talking about it now. That's for next week. It's next week. Okay. It means as opposed to a slave, perhaps, or something like that. There are different classes, even not among slaves. Yeah. There are sections of Tanakh, but you have to think very carefully from a literary perspective what their functions are. Meaning, in other words, you have to look at the stories and the pieces that are told in them. What are you thinking about specifically? Even Yeshua's conquest.
I was thinking about even in the last class,
these kings taking those things next, and then they're going to their like.
I'm not going to go into. But I think in many, not all cases, in many cases, you can actually figure out there is a, I don't know, call pseudo anthropological function to the things that are signaled out. But I don't explain what I mean by that. But there may be purposes for mentioning those kings because of their relevant places. Some of which is lost upon us. Some which is not lost upon us based upon the rest of Tanakh. I don't think, in other words, and the fact is that you are going to get some military history, it's just not the primary focus. So once it focuses on some things and not the others, there's most of the time there's a reason that you can figure out. Right? Okay. Fine. It's easy if you really prefer to write it, you can write it and bring it in. Okay? So next week I'm going to be collecting them. Again, I just want to see that you've done it, you know. Okay. Anyway. In fact, actually, those who do have it, if you could please either leave it after class or send it to me via email if you typed it already. Okay, now on to the topic that obviously relates to Meisha a little bit and to others and the laws we'll be doing, which is as follows. Supposing I went digging. I go digging in Eretz Yisrael, and I dig down to a layer. Which is the 14th century before the Common Era, and I find inscriptions, Hebrew inscriptions. What would I expect that to look like? What type of Hebrew do I expect to find?
14th century.
I hope so. Yes. I hope so. I hope the Hebrew language is invented. If it didn't, we're in a lot of trouble. In some books they say the Hebrew language never developed until the 11th century, but we don't really believe that. So what would you expect? What would you expect the Hebrew to look like? Assuming you found a Hebrew inscription. Okay, so fine, it might be Ksav Ivri, we don't know for sure, it might be Ksav Ivri, fine. Paleo-Hebrew. What else? What would the language itself, not the script, look like? What dialect of Hebrew do you think it would look like? What are different dialects of Hebrew? There's modern Hebrew. Do you think you'd expect to find, a Niyishmor there, you know, or Lo Yodea, which is a modern Hebrew twisting of grammar, modern Israeli twisting of grammar? Would you expect to find that? The answer is no, right? If you dug down under the Plaza Now Hotel and you dug this up, you might find such inscriptions, instructions to the foreman which said Lo Yodea, right? But if you dug down in the 14th century, you wouldn't expect to find that. Would you expect to find Mishnei Hebrew dialect? So you expect to find a biblical Hebrew dialect. That's what I think you would expect to find. Why? You made an assumption there, but I back you into the assumption. Let me ask the following question. Why was the Torah not given in Yiddish? You know, there are a lot of Jews who would say... there's a whole debate about the origin of Yiddish. Some people will tell you Yiddish, and they'll call Yiddish Lashon HaKodesh, right? Okay, but we don't usually assume that way. So it's okay, it didn't exist. So why wasn't it given in Akkadian? Akkadian existed. Yeah. That's what he said. Oh, well, you know, that them is fighting words. I'm not going to argue with you, but you know, there are some Yiddishists who would strongly, I don't know if the Yiddishists would debate that, but there are some firm people who would very strongly debate that point. But let's say Akkadian. So if you said that, then Ezra's comment before might not be correct. He said maybe it's a holy language, it's the first tongue. So you said you'd expect to find other language that way. You expect the language of the inscriptions to look that way, right? But if the Torah was only given in Hebrew because it's a unique language, so then maybe the inscriptions wouldn't look that way. Maybe they'd be written in a different dialect of Hebrew. All we have, unless it's the Bible. Now, I agree with you, but the question is, what am I really asking? So yes... All right, so the question is, what's special about the Hebrew language? Now, I know there are many opinions here, and someone's going to quote me in the Medrash, which I don't really understand. It's either a Zohar or a Bereishis Rabbah. There's a big difference between the two of those. There's a big difference in dating of the two of those, in fact. Bereishis Rabbah can be dated to the 4th century. The Zohar is either dated to the 2nd century or to the 13th century. Okay, I'm not going to tell you which, but it's one of those two.
You should do a
You should read the Art Scroll entry under the Zohar. It's under Moses de Leon, actually. It's very interesting. The questions about the Moshe de Leon, who is was either the publisher or the author of the Zohar, one of the two. It's one of the two, that's for sure. Everybody agrees that he published it. The question is whether he wrote it or not. What's that? Yes. Well, I mean, in academic circles or in firm circles? In firm circles, it was a question. In academic circles, it's clear he wrote it. I'm not telling you, I have no first-hand knowledge of the matter, so I can't offer a comment on it, although my students know that I'm somewhat of a rationalist. I think already even in traditional circles, you look at the Art Scroll entry. I mean, they're obviously very slanted one way, but they do quote, I think, an early, they're not quoting academic, well, they quote academic scholars who insist that the Zohar was written by Rishim Bar Yochai. That I can almost assure you that you'd be hard-pressed to find any academic scholar said that. But then he goes on to quote that early on, I don't know what the Sefer Yuchsin is, and then go bother digging some medieval or early modern work, I guess, that raised questions already about the authorship. So some were not so sure about the authorship early on. But anyway, I'm sorry? So anyway, I know there's a statement about the world was created in Lashon HaKodesh, and when one of you will quote that to me, I'll just ask you what exactly that means, because I have no idea what that means, the world was created. What's that? Well, what did the Well, this is going back to the heart of the question. The reason why it wasn't given in Yiddish or Akkadian of life, I think, is probably because that's what the Jews did not speak. They spoke Lashon HaKodesh. Why is it called Lashon HaKodesh? So, interestingly enough, the Rambam, a very known well known to the Rambam, is that it has no word for the male reproductive organs. That's what the Rambam says. Okay. Look at the discussion at the beginning of Beitza, why they call it Be'ah. The Nosei came on the Mishnah to give an explanation which makes no sense, because Be'ah in Aramaic is the same thing as Beitza in Hebrew. But putting that aside, but the Rambam makes his comment about that. The Ramban says what I believe is correct. The Ramban, anyone know what the Ramban says in Lashon HaKodesh? You know why it's called the Holy Tongue? You want to take a guess, Ezra, since you started it? Because that's what the Torah was given in. Why is it called the Shekel? The Ramban says it on Shekel HaKodesh in Parshas Kisisa. Why is it called Shekel HaKodesh? Is there something uniquely innate, holy about the weight of the Shekel in the Mishkan in the time of the Midbar? No, that's what the Shekel was. That Shekel became used for the Mikdash. That was, it may have been different, maybe it was a different standard. Maybe they used the Chazal say it was twice the normal one, the Shekel HaKodesh. But the fact is, it's called Shekel HaKodesh not because it's inherently holy, because that's what they used for the Mishkan. You might very well use Shekel HaKodesh, you know, in any of your business dealings, if that's what you chose to do. If you wanted to charge somebody a premium price, you'd say, you pay me 30 shekelim b'shekel HaKodesh, if it was double the weight. Now, in a certain sense, if you want to raya a little bit to the Ramban, and even the Ramah might agree with the Ramban's basic point, is the fact, the famous statement of the Gemara, that Dvarim, I think it's the Gemara on Shabbos, maybe in the first parak, that Dvarim shel Kodesh, when you're in the bathroom or another place like that, you're allowed to speak Hebrew, but you're not allowed to speak in Divrei Kodesh, even if it's in a foreign language. Okay, it's not the language that seems to have innate holiness. If it had innate holiness per se, then it's not clear why it would be mutter in a makom hametunach. Okay, I'm making the assumption the Ramban is correct. That's why it's called Biblical Hebrew. And hence, when you dig down in the 14th century, you expect to find inscriptions. If you found inscriptions in Hebrew, it would look very much like the Biblical Hebrew of the Torah. That makes sense. Change the dating by a couple of centuries, and what do you expect? Well, if you go later, so you expect it to be, you know, maybe Hebrew that reflects more the Hebrew of a monarchic period. You have David and Shlomo. Did the Hebrew language change at all over the course of the time in Tanakh? Of course it did. Sometimes it creates problems, sometimes it doesn't, but certain linguistic features certainly develop later. The example I always like to give is she instead of asher. You have that the occurrence of she in the Torah and in Nevi'im, I think all Nevi'im, I'm not 100% sure, certainly early Nevi'im, occurs a total, I think, of three times, and it may be archaic forms. Bishagam Hu Vasar is the only one in the Torah, and you have in Shiras Devorah, and poetry always preserves archaic forms, Ad Shakamti Devorah, and you have one by Gideon, I think, At Sho'atam Edaberimi, that's why the Nikud in Modim is Sho'atahu Hashem Elokim, not Sheh. Okay, whatever. Anyway, so you expect language to change. Now, I think this, in a certain sense, is what Chazal mean in a larger sense also by Dibra Torah Kalashon B'nei Adam. Dibra Torah Kalashon B'nei Adam can mean many things. For Chazal, in the strictest sense, anyone know where that comes up, Dibra Torah Kalashon B'nei Adam?
Have I got speeches?
I'm sorry?
No.
No, that's Kedela Saber Sosa. By Darshani, you know, Himol Yimol. Okay, Hashiv, Hashiv Lo. There's double, those, I can't recall them. It's infinitive plus finite form of the verb, right? An infinitive has no time, person, number, gender. Lishmoa, okay? To hear. It's not he heard, she heard, she is hearing. There's no singular plural. That's called an infinite form of the verb, an infinitive. So that form of infinitive plus finite verb, shamoa tishmu'u amitzosai. So Chazal always darts from that. Interestingly enough, and the Gemara in several places suggests that it's a machlokas of Akiva and Yishmael, whether you say Dibra Torah Kalashon B'nei Adam. Happens to be, if you look at the Psak of the Rambam, it's not consistent. Most of the time he paskins the double Lashon, the Darshan, but sometimes he paskins the single Lashon. Okay. Anyway, so it certainly is a halakhic notion, but I think at a more obvious level, it speaks about language. What does it mean, Dibra Torah Kalashon B'nei Adam? It refers, I think, first to lexicon, to the dictionary, the usage of vocabulary that you expect to find in Tanakh. And there are differences. There are words that only appear in the later books of Tanakh. Some of them are foreign words, you know, what we call loan words. Some of them are not. But they appear only in later books. You know, for example, you know what the English word chrysanthemum means? You know what it is, right? It's a kind of flower. What color is it? No, it's like yellow or goldish. It happens to be that there's the Greek word is chrysos, which means gold, okay? Which comes from, that actually is a loan word from Semitic languages. You have in Ugaritic, you have kuratsu, is the normal word for gold. And if you learn, say, from Mishle, you will find the word charutz means something different than it means in other places. And this root means something different. It means gold. You have kesef and charutz used in parallel or together, meaning kesef is the hub. So you have different kinds of words that may come from different periods and different influence, different places, depending on where the book of Tanakh and when the book of Tanakh was composed. Grammar doesn't change tremendously, but you will find probably certain forms. You know, in relatively later sections of Tanakh, you won't find in earlier forms. Some of them may be under the influence of Aramaic. If you take the idea of a someone in my share mentioned this. In Hallel, I'm sorry? I don't know if modern Hebrew uses it or not. But you take the form Linpol, okay? The Ho Dechisani Linpol, right? It's a little strange, isn't it? You actually stopped and thought about what do you expect it to be? Lipol, right? The nun should have assimilated. That is an Aramaic feature, an Aramaic influence, okay? Without giving a specific date on it. You find that also in the later parts of the book of Yeshayahu. V'chol atzvechem tin gosu, not ki gosu, which is the normal form. So you expect certain grammatical features perhaps to change. Idiom, especially. Okay, this is one that I mentioned in this context. I know it's going to disturb some people. I find it rather enlightening, but maybe that's because I've thought about it or I've heard it so many times. What does it mean, ki olam maves bachaloneinu, bab armanoseinu? What does it mean, ki olam maves bachaloneinu? What does that mean? It's close. It's common, okay? Right, death is rampant. That's what it means. I agree. No, isn't that mechutz tishak yocher mechadarim eimada? You're thinking about that, no? Anyway, so this is a funny etymology. Is that a funny idiom? Death is coming through the windows. Okay, you might wish to find out what the origin of that is as well. I can tell you almost certainly. Based upon the finds of Ugaritic literature, what ki alam avas b'chaloneinu is there was a large body of mythic poetry, call it that was found at Ugarit, modern city of Ras Shamra in Syria. It's shortly, it's a little distance from the coast. It may have once upon a time, when the sea was at a different level, may have been on the coast. But the finds at Ugarit have contained a lot of mythic literature which deal with the Ugaritic gods, whose names I think you will probably recognize. The chief god in the Ugaritic pantheon was El. Among El's sons were Baal, whom you certainly will recognize. His wife was, I believe, I'm going to make it this confused, was Athirah, which is Asherah in Hebrew, unless it was Ashtoreth, I forget which. Then one was a daughter, I think. Also he had two children gods, if you call them that. One whose name was Yam, and one whose name, pronounced by the way the Semitists pronounce it, was Mot, okay, or Mother. Now, one of the stories you find in which Baal is having the artisan gods build him a palace. And he tells them to make sure that the palace has no windows. And the reason why he tells them to make sure the palace has no windows is because his arch enemy, one of his two arch enemies, Mot, he's already, I think, vanquished Yam. Okay, but Mot, one of his arch enemies, the way he kills his victims, the way he ambushes them, is he comes through the windows. So, once you've read that story, you look at the idiom that says, Ki Allah maves bahaloneinu, and it becomes pretty obvious what the origin of the etymology is. Now, whether Yirmiyahu HaNavi in his day already still knew what the etymology was, I don't know. One might suppose that if the expression still had the taints of idol worship, he would not have used such an expression, right? And it may have been by Yirmiyahu's time it's sort of already fallen out, and it was just an expression. Now, when people say, geez, I can't believe that, that's really a shortened form of Jesus, right? Now, if you think about it, you really shouldn't use the expression, right? But what is it? It's not, you know, it probably starts out by Jesus or something like that, which is a kind of swearing. Now, we don't use it as swearing anymore. We just use it as a point of exclamation. Probably shouldn't, right? But it's 400 years from now, if there were no Christianity, so the phrase might lose any of its taint and stigma, right? Okay, you know, by then you might say, you know, Jesus and think that he was, you know, a shortstop for some baseball team or something like that and not realize he was a god, and that would be perfectly fine. So whether Yirmiyahu HaNavi still knew the etymology when he used it, it's in the Torah, by the way, of Tisha B'Av, in Perek Ches or Tes, of Yirmiyahu. So whether he knew is a separate question, but the bottom line is, based upon, you can see that an idiom that meant something then might not mean something in a later context. Yeah?
So a little more about how really that the language.
The Jews didn't live in ghettos. It's not surprising. You ever read the Mishnah? You ever study, read the Mishnah? You know the Mishnah, right? You've read it? Did you know what, you know what the second most common language after Hebrew in the Mishnah is?
What?
If you tell me Aramaic, the answer is you're wrong.
Yeah.
Greek. And this is in rabbinic circles. You don't know what was the case in Amoraic circles. Probably Aramaic may have been in the spoken tongue. But then I would venture to guess there is almost certainly more Greek in the Mishnah than there is Aramaic. Never, not necessarily Greek phrases, but Greek words. Why? Because that's what happens when cultures meet. You know, I'm not going to call that Torah Mada. That's just the, you know. You know, the Ravs are reputed to have said, you know, the Ravs had a very seemingly different take on how to respond, you know, to the challenges of America than most other Gedolim did. The Rav was opposed to withdrawing into a ghetto. He once apparently, I think he writes that in the Chamesh Drashos, about the 14th Ikar he would have added, if he could add an Ikar. And I'm told, I don't know if he says this there, but I'm told the reason why he said that, he says, well, you can't build walls, because if you build walls, the material is going to seep in anyway. You may as well confront it, because you don't have a choice. Now that's true now, beginning of that, I don't care about the Rav's position or the Rav's position, I don't want to get into the argument, what did the Rav really say? But that I think, historically speaking, is a true point. You can't, you know, unless you literally cut off all contact with the outside world, which almost nobody does, you can't stop the cultural influence. You know, it's just going to happen. It's just going to happen. So it's not a shock. It's not a shock to find, you know, loan words from other languages in Tanakh. Because, you know, people had exposure to other cultures, and therefore there was trade in the ancient world, and therefore you're not surprised. Question or just, no, okay. All right, now, why then can archaeology be so important? Take Ki Olam Avos B'Chaloneinu, right? We knew in this case what the pasuk meant, but we didn't really understand the etymology. But let me sort of, there are other cases where Rishonim really did not know. Chazal don't talk about it, particularly more in the Bimim Ktuvim, where Chazal didn't, where the Rishonim didn't know what certain words meant, they didn't understand the references because the cultural references are lost. But let me give you the following sort of example in a modern way. The last time Yeshiva learned Shabbos, so I don't know what room we're in, it's either this room or that room. I sat a room upstairs listening to Rosh Hashanah give shir, and I remember that he was talking about Misafek. And so he said, well, okay, so what's the din in a baseball game? A guy's standing there, and someone hits a fly ball, and he's not paying any attention, and the ball just winds up in his glove, and he catches it. And he has no awareness whatsoever. So I'm just telling him he's not out, right? So we told him that, of course, you are out, okay? Now, I may even have that written in my notes, okay? So I have a comment about a fly ball and an outfielder, okay? Now, supposing that United States civilization is plowed over, it's destroyed because they elected whoever the wrong president is, and I'm not telling who I'm voting for. Some of you might be surprised, but not a comment of who's whoever you think that the guy is going to destroy America is, okay? And now, supposing someone discovers my notes, someone has my notes, they print my notes through Shech Tashu. Okay, so all Ramazim of the Red Sox breaking or not breaking the curse or almost breaking the curse in the year 2004 are lost. Everything is basically destroyed. There's no record. All the New York Times records are burned. The microphone destroyed. You don't know about baseball except for this reference in my notes. So now you live 400 years later. You discover this book. You have this book. Okay, let's say it's been transmitted, but it's certainly not an important point to baseball. And now someone's trying to figure out, well, what does this mean? An outfielder? A fly ball? Okay, so nobody really knows. They give all sorts of interesting guesses. Okay, maybe somebody thinks that, there are birds that fly in the backyard or something like that. You know, whatever it is, they have no idea. And then the archaeologists are digging near Flushing Bay, and they uncover a stadium. And there is the broken outfield sign, which says, baseball on it or something like that. So what do the archaeologists do? They put two and two together. They say, And then they start to understand, maybe they find, Joe Torre's playbook or something, okay, wrong stadium, but wherever, buried, and they pull it out and start to put the pieces together, and they're going to have to do a lot of speculating, right? They didn't find the Major League, the last revision of the Major League rule book, but they start to get a certain sense of certain things, and they'll get some things right, some things wrong, but the general context, they will manage to cull to put together a literary source and an archaeological find. Well, that's what happens frequently with biblical archaeology, that there are references, words, phrases, cultural references, idioms that are in Tanakh that basically without knowing the reality, you have really no way of knowing exactly what they mean. Frequently, you can sort of guess from context. You can get a good guess, and you may even get it right sometimes. But sometimes not, because you just don't have enough information, and it's frequently not important enough. But with archaeological finds, you can go much farther. Now the question is, do we like this or do we not like this? So today, a lot of people probably don't like it for multiple theological reasons. From my perspective, the only theological reason to avoid such things is if it creates sufficient problems for Emunas Deus, which you can accomplish avoiding those problems in one of two ways. You can completely close off those issues and pretend they don't exist, or you can at least, I would say not confront the issues, but at least you can selectively take that which you consider acceptable and valuable. Most biblical archaeology has very little relevance to Tanakh. Meaning, okay, so you find pottery from Jews who lived in the 9th century. Okay, so we know that people use pottery. Very nice. You find more pottery. And more pottery, right? The things that likely survive. Very big deal. Occasionally important things are found. Occasionally. So anyway, the question is, though, how do we feel about using foreign sources in the interpretation of Tanakh? So some people immediately recoil from it. So I would first point out to you the Rambam. Did I not hand out that sheet? That would be a travesty. I did not, did I? I think I left it in my office. Right? Did somebody hand out the one sheet with the Mar Nevuchim or no? How did I want? Oh, I say, pulled it off the top. Okay, someone want to eat that anymore? My office. It's, where my office is? 322. It's like right next to the bathroom there. And on the desk opposite me when you enter, look for, this should be like a pile of 25-30 sheets of, it has the Rambam, Mar Nevuchim, and a Rashi, an Ibn Ezra, and a Ramban on it. Okay. So the Rambam, and this, before we get to that, I'll make one comment. The Rambam is a very interesting comment to Shimon Efrachim. This, I believe, is fundamentally one of the most important theological issues of modernity, which Orthodox Jews of various stripes grapple with. The Rambam, anyone know what Shimon Efrachim is? is Introduction to Avos. So the Rambam writes there, near the end of the Hakdama to Shemona Prakim, I think this is not one of the Shemona Prakim, okay, he writes, I'll just translate for you, and be aware that the things that I say in these chapters, and those things in the commentary, are not things that I made up myself, and not chidushin that I was mefaresh, but rather I gathered them from Chazal, the Midrashim, Talmud, and elsewhere, and from the words of the philosophers, and both ancient and recent from works of mankind. And listen to the truth from whoever says it. And sometimes I might bring something which is well known, okay, a well known expression. And there's nothing wrong with it, the fact that I don't quote who I'm quoting it from, because I'm not claiming myself. I'm not trying to say this is my. I'm not boasting. I'm not mispoyer, using somebody else's Torah to make myself look good, because I'm already acknowledging here that it's not mine. Okay, and I'm not even going to bother to say so that somebody said. I'm not going to bother. And why? Because there's no need to lengthen my commentary that way. And in addition, thank you. And in addition, maybe one, and then you can have that. And in addition, he says, it might be that someone who doesn't like that person, I will cause him not to believe it. That's a very loose translation. At least, "Ulai egrom sheikanes delayed misheinam akubal alav shemo so adam sheosu adavar nifsad v'yeshvo kavanara sheinei yadu alav." Unafikach, therefore, nirali lahashmit shema omer. I'm just going to leave out the attribution. I want people to understand what the Masechta really says. So why do you think the Rama really left out the citations? Who were his readers going to reject? Aristotle. So the answer is, I'm not going to tell you who said it. You know, it's a lot of Chazal, but some philosophy. You know why? Because you're supposed to accept the way the Rama is frequently quoted as Kabbalah emesli mishamara. Truth stands on its own two legs. You don't need an author to stand behind it. Okay, that obviously, you have to ask, you know, nowadays it's hard to find a sefer that's published without a haskama. Okay, I find that to be a little bit funny. I assume a haskama in some places serves as a hashgacha, and in some cases it's, you hope it's going to sell you more books. But I don't think the Rama, when he published his Mishneh Torah, went around and got a haskama from his contemporary gedolim. Nor when Rashi published his commentary. It'd be interesting if someone is curious to research when you first start finding haskamas. Introductions, haskamas are fascinating to read also. You know, some haskamas read like, I have no idea, I don't know this person, I just met him once, but he seems like a nice fellow, so buy his book. When the author hasn't even read it, you have to read haskamas carefully. Right? But anyway, so yes. That's possible. And there was a point at which there was sort of a harem on republishing certain things so the author could recoup his money. I don't know if that's when Haskamas originated, which said that, you know, we the undersigned say you may not print this book for X number of years or whatever because he's put money into it and he has to be allowed to recoup his money. I don't know if that's connected to the modern Haskamas. But, yeah. Most of these Sfarim aren't read by little kids. You presume they're read by somebody. To be able to read most of these Sfarim, you have to have half a brain. Well, you know, the truth is, there are lots of if you're talking about Sfira, it's obvious in its own right. If you're talking about whether the Sefer is actually good or not, there is so much dribble that's written that has Haskamas or Gedolim on it. You know, it almost becomes a pro forma thing. Right? So, the truth is, do you need Haskamas? No. Will some people not buy your book? I don't know. Torah journals don't yet have a haskama on them. Not that I see. Yes?
I've heard some people say that one should not be reading Morning Book.
Yeah, don't you know? The Mishneh Torah was written by Rambam and the Morning Book was written by Maimonides. One of them was Firma, one of them was an Apikars. You know, in Maimonidean studies, Professor Twersky, Zichrono Lebracha's great contribution, was that, you know, once upon there was a part of the world that basically was Goresh the Rambam and Mishneh Torah, not Mor Nebuchim. And then there was Leo Strauss, who basically thought that the Rambam was a closet heretic who used the Mishneh Torah for coverage, which is absurd as well. And Professor Twersky's, you know, contribution, one of his, maybe his major contribution, was to insist upon, you know, a whole view of the Rambam as one person. So it's hard, you know. So yes, there was a cheirem, and you know, there was a cheirem. I don't know about Marmi and Marnevuchim. I did burn the Rambam's books. There was a whole study of medieval Jewish history for that. There was a cheirem at some point, not studying philosophy until you were 40. But I'm not sure the Marnevuchim was included in that. I think it was secular works philosophy. But I'm sure that I'm also opposed to reading the Marnevuchim.
It wouldn't be
new. Did he? That was the first such attempt, I guess. Okay, but I don't think it's seriously disputed. I don't think it's seriously disputed. Let's talk about it. Now that we've spoken about the Rambam's view, before we trash the Rambam as philosopher, let's give you a passage that some would regard as radical in Marnevuchim. But the Rambam's a pretty big tree. This is a stunning passage. Professor Eichler quotes this in his article, which you should have read, and you hopefully will read. It's an unbelievable passage. He writes as follows: Chomash and Elam Tamu Meiroba Chukim. The Rambam is just given various explanations for Chukim in the Torah. Various, some are not just pure Chukim. And Eino Rak Laharchik Mevada Zara. It's really to distance oneself from the pagan cults. Now look what he says: Ve'elu Apratam Asher Nala Mimeni Tamu V'lo Yadati Toel Tam. Those things that I could not explain fully, the Rambam says, whom nation in advarim anishmarin kedvarim anerim la'ayin, as we say that Chazal said lo teishmira gedolam eriya, we would say that seeing is believing. Right? It's not the same thing hearing about something as actually seeing it. Ubavur ze ein ze. I mean, the Rambam never saw these idolatrous cults. He's only reading about them in these vestiges, these sperm that he found. Ubavur ze ein ze ashir asher dati ani mideos hatzava mimash shmati ben asvarim kemo shiyada yada usom isharam asem hagluyim. I, who only learned about the Sabaeans from books, it's not the same as having first-hand knowledge of what witnessing their practices. The chosha came b'shkakeh deos ahem miyos apayim shana meayom apayim shana v'imachol shemam. And the fact that this sect, this cult, these idolaters are no longer found. It's been 2,000 years since they disappeared. Now, when you go back 2,000 years, it starts to get you back almost to the period of the Torah, when they ceased to exist, or when they did exist during the time the Torah was given. If we knew more details about the Sabaeans, then you could explain all the details of Karbanos and Tumah the Tara. Everything would be clear if only you knew more about the Sabaeans. I will only suffer with that, but I have no doubts. Ki hakol haya limchos hadeus ahem habilti amitius nev adam. The purposes of all these laws in the Torah was to obliterate, was to counteract those opinions. Ulevatel hamasim ahem shein b'moel kasher kilu hayam b'tov v'hevel, and to do away with these meaningless practices. Ubitlu hadeus ahem ashevas adam echakort siyur muskal masos masimol, because those opinions, those beliefs led people astray from doing productive things and intelligent things. And he quotes the pasuk from Yirmiyahu. And look at the last line. See what a great loss is? If they had broken the Mishnah inscription, what a terrible loss it would have. Had they broken it, we couldn't have read it at all. What a loss it would have been. That's what the Rambam says. Now, I forget that he's quelling over the loss of the doctrines and laws of the Sabaeans. Forget that part. The Rambam is saying something exceedingly, exceedingly radical here, or seemingly radical, which I believe is not radical at all when you actually start to think about reality, but it's going to raise some questions for you. Yeah?
Yeah, I think the Rambam is confusing. I always thought that Avodah Zarah is not just worshiping another god, but something that distracts you from worshiping.
Fine, that's very nice. That's not radical. I mean, that's fine.
You would say TV is the Shabbat Zarah, then.
I'm sorry?
You would say something like TV is the Shabbat Zarah.
Well, I'll vote for that anyway, and I'll vote for that. If you listen to that sock, I'll tell you that you shouldn't watch television. Fine, I'll go along with it. But okay, unless you're watching the Yankees being beaten in the seventh game, not that I think I saw an out or two. But the point is that on a logical plane, Bittul Torah is Bittul Torah. I don't know if you call it Mamash Avodah Zarah. In other words, you don't. Remember, this is not a statement about halacha. Right? The fact that the Sabaeans are gone, the Rambam doesn't say we don't have to do Karbanos anymore. We don't have to be Nisr and Tumvatar anymore, right? He doesn't say that. Even in a purely monotheistic world, the Rambam wouldn't say that. So it's not a halachic statement, and that goes both ways. But it's something more fundamental, I think, the assumption the Rambam is making, which at first is very radical and disturbing, I'm not trying to reorient your entire theology or walk out saying I have an entirely different theology than you do, but you think about what he's saying actually becomes a necessity. And what is that, Ayon? No, that's not so disturbing, because even Chazal basically, you know, said that, yeah, we could give, you know, reasons being given. Rambam's not the only one giving reasons for Chukim. The Ramban explains Kilayim with a different approach, and so on. So that in itself isn't so radical. I mean, it's a little. I'm sorry. But the fact is, Rishonim were doing it. Okay, so one of the reasons I think there were concerns about this is the people using this as the license to disregard them. So yeah, I'm not saying everybody's doing, but it's pretty frequent. You know, I think the Tosus and Gittin who writes like that basically the argument about Drashin and Taimi Dikra is not whether or not you can be Dorish Taimi Dikra, it's whether you use it to regulate the application of the din. Right. Yes, Evan?
I would assume that the problem is that the Rambam is saying that the Torah is a reaction to the time.
Okay, so what the Rambam is saying, in a nicer way of putting it, is that Torah Shebichtav, in particular, is contextually rooted. Okay? Now, it's a different way of saying it, but let me ask you the following question. Did Chazal, in effect, not already say this? So let me ask you a question. I'm reading your pasuk from Mishpatim. It says, I'll translate it to English. It says, if you drive your car into your neighbor's wall, so then it depends. If you were in fourth gear, so then you're high enough to pay kefa. If you were in first gear, so you potter. If you're second or third gear, then you have to pay karen. Why is that ridiculous? Why did it say shore? Let me ask you a question. Does the shore have any relevance in your life?
No.
So how do we get from shore to car? The answer is that's the function of Torah Shua Peh, interpretation. It starts with Chazal's statement, Dibar HaKasuv Behoveh. Now, I realize that you're going to say to me, well, Dibar HaKasuv Behoveh just means case law. Right? Case law. It means when you give me a case in particular, you pick a case that's relevant to that time. Because obviously you couldn't speak about car, because if the Torah had written car in there, nobody would have understood what it meant. Right? Okay. So that's very nice. But, let me ask you a question. Did the Torah have any choice? In other words, that one wants to argue there are certain principles in the Torah we understand. But, did the Torah have any choice? Did the Torah Shebichtav have any choice but to be contextually rooted? You've already seen that the language has to be contextually rooted, because in order, let's put it this way. Biblical Hebrew, whether or not it's Kodesh intrinsically or Kodesh because of historical circumstances, had to have been a language spoken by the Jews at the time of Matan Torah. Otherwise nobody would have understood it. If the Torah had been given in Hungarian, nobody, including Moshe Rabbeinu, would have understood it. I don't think, unless, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu knew the new 70 languages, and Hungarian was one of them, okay? I don't know if Chazal ever said that Moshe Rabbeinu knew 70 languages. Yosef knew 70 languages, right? The Sanhedrin you had, okay, whatever. I don't think they met any Hungarians there. You only had to know all the languages on the Sanhedrin to be Makabaladus, but, and Sanhedrin on Gadol anyway wasn't Makabaladus normally. That was just for determining law. So the fact is, the Torah Shavuot Tzav, to some extent, has to be contextually rooted. There's just no other way. Now, of course, that raises the question, which is, what is that? Then how is the Torah eternal? So the basic answer, and it's, but that's what the Rambam says. Don't accuse me of saying that's what the Rambam says. So how do we explain the Rambam's position? The answer is that's the role of Torah Shabbat Peh. Torah Shabbat Peh's responsibility, just as Torah Shabbat Peh said, it's not only Shor, it's Dibar HaKasuv Behoveh, it's Shor Shor Misinai, Shor and Kol Behemah, and we can extrapolate from Shor somehow, whatever category Mnezek, to a car, it might actually be Adam HaMazik, not Shor HaMazik, but we can extrapolate, that's the role of Torah Shabbat Peh. Torah Shabbat Peh is what allows the Torah to be a living Torah. If all you had was Torah Shebichtav by its very definition, by being formulated in a certain language with a certain set of cases, in a certain context, by very definition has to limit it. Yes, I know. Well, in the Rambam's view of Torah Shebaal Peh, the original Torah Shebaal Peh was very limited. It contained Halach L'Moshe Misinai, which had no basis in scripture, so in effect it's a different Torah being given, and it contained Peirushim HaMekubalim, what we call received interpretations of various psukim in the Torah. So in other words, you do need it. You know, Albeck's point, that makes a point, an obvious point, to some of us. In his Mavol LaMishnah, in his introduction to the Mishnah, Chanoch Albeck was one of the great Israeli scholars, a product of the European Batei Medrash. I mean, it was Nifter probably, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, and one of sort of the founding fathers of modern Mishnah scholarship. So Albeck writes in his Mavol LaMishnah that, by definition, whenever you have a written document, there immediately has to be a Torah Shvalpa with it. You can't have it. Pre-Eitz Hadar had to mean something when it was written by Moshe, given to Moshe Rabbeinu by the Baruch Shalom. It had to mean something by then. So you needed an interpretation immediately. Not everything. No, the point is, pre-Eitz Hadar, you know what the words meant. You just didn't know which. There are a lot of beautiful trees. So that with the role that initially you're going to have a role of Torah Shvah Peh to explain Scripture. Now, when new circumstances came up that weren't addressed by Scripture, and that could happen very soon, you also have Torah Shvah Peh for that. So the point is that the Rambam's position, and initially it does seem radical, although it's really just an expansion of what Chazal said already. But in some ways, it's absolutely necessary. And it fits in very well with this concept of Torah Shebal Peh. I think I've spoken about that before. You can read the introduction to the Perush HaMishnayos, the five categories of Torah Shebal Peh, three of which are the Mordeh Oraisa. But that's what the Rambam says. Now, even if you don't, you know, I would add one other comment which I think is important, because students have occasionally spoken to me because they've sort of taken the Rambam and then sort of started to wonder. And so what relevance do these, if there are no more Sabaeans, and assuming there were no more idolaters, which is not true, so what relevance do these particular, you know, mitzvahs have? So I think one of a corollary that has to go with this is that one of the rows of, is that, you know, Kilayim, Shatnez in its original context, may be an anti-Avodah Zarah polemic. But one of the roles of Torah Shebal Peh of interpretation is to find meaning in mitzvahs of the Torah that are relevant even beyond that. Meaning, the Ramban has a very interesting suggestion on Kalayim. I'm not sure whether we accept it or not. But the role of Torah Shebal Peh, and the assumption is that the mitzvahs of the Torah potentially contain many meanings, and the role of Torah Shebal Peh is to make Torah Shebichtav relevant in every generation. Now, there are legal canons which says that Shatnez is Asr, period. It doesn't matter whether you understand it or not. There also may be ways of making Shatnez relevant with logic in any particular generation. Now, whether you like the Ramban's explanation or not, that's the kind of approach one may take. When the Rambam gives these explanations, he's sort of giving you the original explanation, or the one that was most obvious and relevant in his generation that may have prompted it. You know, the question is obviously raised for the Rambam, if the Torah were given today, would it contain these things in it? And that's the question you want to ask. So the Torah was given at Sinai, it's Lamu Levaneinu Adalam, Lasos is called the Re'at Harazos. Now, I believe actually if you look elsewhere, a little early in the Mor Nevuchim, he does sound like, if it hadn't been for these idolaters, that the mitzvah might not have been given. It would have been unnecessary. That's a little bit shocking on the one hand. On the other hand, okay, so that's, you know, so you can like or not like the Rambam, that's what the Rambam says. Yeah. I'm sorry?
Just make one. No Avodah Zarah or anything that has any affiliation to it that anybody's doing today.
So by the same question of when you had the Nesiyim, why did the Torah repeat 12 times and give us the longest parsha? Well, okay, an hour turns. The longest parsha in the Torah, when it could have just said, this was the Karban, you know, the Eilah HaNesiyim, Asher Hiviyu Karbanam Lefnei Hashem, Biyom Chanukas HaMishkan, and said, Lematei Yehuda, Kalei Ben Yifuneh, Lematzah, and so forth. Why didn't they do it? The answer is, I don't know. It's a literary style. I mean, let's put it this way. It's not as if there aren't more details. The fact that, remember also, these laws are binding. The question is, what meaning you find them is a separate issue. So in other words, they were relevant at the time. You know, if you don't find new meaning, then what you end up, the importance of finding new meaning through Torah Shebal Peh, of all these things, is that you don't feel like you're observing a Torah because God told you to, even though it's no longer relevant. Right? We all face on a regular basis a similar, more obvious and less controversial theological problem with Dinim Drabanan. Okay, do you take medicine on Shabbos when you're not know full of Mishkav? The answer is you don't. You're not supposed to. It's also according to the Gemara, Zeris or Fuah. Okay, now all medicines, some medicines may be called Machabri, and whatever it is, whatever you hold, there are certain medicines when a person's not really sick, you know, but then, Mechosh Fialma, a little headache, but, you know, I can function, which you're not allowed to take. I mean, I'm just picking one example. You could pick, you know, a non-controversial example. Do you take those medicines, Shabbos? The answer is no. Why not? Because you might go to an apothecary and he might grind up the spices. Does that have any relevance in your life? And the answer is no. You keep Yom Tov Sheni. Right? Does Yom Tov Sheni have any relevance in our lives? The answer is absolutely not. We know the calendar, it's set. If there was probably if there was some, it's unlikely that that would be chozer l'kukulo, that you couldn't, that even if we were Mekadesh Api Hariya, that you wouldn't pick up the phone, you know, or the cell phone and just call across to America and say that today was Rosh Chodesh. And the entire world has gotten, you know, has gotten within 10 seconds of each other. You can find that anywhere in the world. Does it have any relevance to our lives? The answer is, in halach, pure halachic, the answer is no, we do it anyway. Why? The answer is because davar shebamin, sarach minyanah halatira. I'm not trying to, you should observe all the Shulchan Aruch, don't get me wrong. But it raises a theological, fundamental theological problem. I've seen quoted, I saw Meshech Chachma, I've heard this quoted before, the Gra says that all mitzvahs to Rabbanon have a sod as well. Now, I don't think I doubt the Gra said it, because it runs against all, a lot of things are attributed to the Gra, if you didn't say them. I think the only work I'm aware of on Torah Shabbat, I think he wrote the stuff on Tanakh, but the only work on Torah Shabbat I think that the Gra wrote was the Bir Halacha, not Bir Halacha, what's it called? What's on the Shulchan Aruch? Bir HaGra? Bir HaGra on the Shulchan Aruch. Everything else is really collected and rearranged from that material. But, what's that?
From one area, you say,
that's not the way you hear it quoted. But even say all, it's one thing to say that sometimes mitzvahs d'rabbanan have more than one cause, but the fact is the way poskim have worked for hundreds and hundreds of years is that when you're looking to find the kula, you basically find what you think the reason, and you have to get around the davar shebamin problem, but basically you find that reason for the particular din and you assume that's the only reason. And once you do away with that, you've done away with it. You don't say, but what about the other six reasons or so? But what is that? What is that an issue? What do I believe that that type of an answer, the Deen of the Rabban will have sowed? Okay? I think that's partially, whether it was intended originally that way, I don't know, an attempt to grapple with a theological problem. And it's a relatively minor theological problem, it's a practical problem. Why do we do all these things in our lives if they're no longer relevant? The only reason we do them is because since there was a Xerus energy, you need another Xerus to master it. Right? So the answer is we do it. We do it. But sometimes you stop and think about it, it's troubling. So in the same sense, and that's why you don't want to, so just as you would like to find meaning, however you do it, in Dinam Drabbanan, even if it wasn't intended originally that way, in the same sense, Torah Shabbat Peh, here we might say it was originally intended that way, it's a divine document, it's not a human product, that the goal, one of the goals of Torah Shabbat Peh, is to create relevance, to find within, mitzos and isurim, relevance in every generation, messages and so on. The halacha is binding, but that's the role of Torah Shabbat Peh. I understand what you're asking, but the fact is that the Torah Shel Chassad, someone said, well, is almost all of Torah for that generation. Every generation goes on, you need more and more Torah Shel Chassad. But for that generation, the Torah Shel Chassad was almost everything. The only Torah Shel Chassad that existed, according to the Rambam at least, were halakha and mishnayos, which are not in the text at all, so they basically become another text, and interpretations of, at Sinai, at minute zero, giving you the Torah, what existed with the halakha mishmi Sinai and the Perushim HaMekubalim, which is just interpreting the text. So in Echanan, that was the Torah Shabbat Sav and Torah Shabbat at its time. Okay, but that's what the Rambam says. I didn't make that up. So, based upon the Rambam, even without taking it to mitzvahs and dinim, even if you want to take halacha and sort of exempt it from the parsha a little bit, but certainly it would be less controversial on all the narrative portions of Tanakh, where if you wanted to understand them better, you might find that having information about what people did and the way people thought once upon a time would certainly be a useful thing. What else now? So that's one addition that one gets from what we call, the heading of this topic is called what? The ancient Near East. Okay? Second example is linguistics. I remember once one of my rabbeim, I asked this already, because any Rabbi Dulitz expatriates? No. Really? Okay. So I remember when I was in graduate school, shortly, I started graduate school probably 10 plus, over 10 years ago, and I was went back to say hello to Rabbi Dulitz, and I was asked, what are you learning? So I spoke about, I was doing a study of Akkadian Ugaritic at the time, and he said, he wasn't get angry, but he said, I gave him some examples where it might help understand certain words, and he said, nah. Poo-pooing that, and I said, Rebbe, but Rashi, Rashi and Ibn Ezra, they use Arabic words. which they do in fact, right? So I gave you an example. In other words, the Rishonim were not afraid to Rashi. Not just Ibn Ezra did that, but Rashi, who didn't know Arabic himself, but he's obviously drawing upon, I'm guessing, Menachem or Dunash, or one of these earlier works. So Rashi and Ibn Ezra, for example, this is not the only place. There are many places where Ibn Ezra invokes Lashon Arabi. But Rashi on Shemos Yudbeis test, Al Tochlu Mimenu Na, what does he say? What is Na? She'enu Tzalui Kol Tzarko Koro Na B'Lashon Arabi. It's called Na. How would we translate it? Partially raw. Okay. So right now, what does that mean? It means it's a Hebrew word. That means the same thing as an Arabic word. It's just that the Hebrew word is a very rare word. Now, Ibn Ezra has a very interesting suggestion, which is that he quotes Rashi in the end, but I'm curious to see if any of you can figure out what he means by this comment. No, yesh omim kasher huata shabasar chai, like it is now that the meat is raw. Uvedera hadas lamatzim b'chamekba. You never find no used that way. And then at the end, the last line, he writes, he quotes other interpretations, and he says the last line, "Abasar achai yikaru." The line before, "Ki rov lashon arabi doma lashon ivris." Okay, that Arabic and Hebrew are very similar. A little bit of an exaggeration, rov, but certainly, there is a tremendous amount of overlap. I mean, I don't know, quite a rov, but "Abasar achai yikru lashon arabi nay." Okay, so that's sort of the more the, like, Rashi's obviously not quoting Ibn Ezra because he lived before Ibn Ezra, but obviously he's quoting from a similar tradition. What does Ibn Ezra mean? This is just for fun. Okay, my idea of fun is taking a good biblical parish and trying to figure out what he's really doing in the text. A Rashi, a Ramban, and Ibn Ezra. It's not something you've been trained to do. That we'll do a little bit of that in the last 3 weeks. And if I'm actually, up to speed and not burdened by other obligations, I may actually pull out new selections. I might even do something a little different, like, which is do Parshas HaShavua pieces to see how well you read Rashi and Chumash and a couple of other Mefarshim. I hope this is sort of just as a little, as a opportunity for you to learn, figure out what you don't know and what you have to learn and how to learn. But we'll see. Otherwise, I'll just be looking at a standard list of Mefarshim. We'll provide interesting examples, but I'm getting tired of doing them. So anyway, what does Ibn Ezra mean when he says "Kasheru ata shabasachai"? Ibn Ezra, by the way, is very difficult to read. He's very terse. What does the word "na" mean? Does anyone know what Ibn Ezra means? Take a look at it. Give me 30 seconds. Just get me some paper towels. Okay. What's that? There are none. Thank you. All right. I had a fear I was going to do this. Too much water. Okay. Should do a commercial here for how absorbent they are. No. There's no. Okay. Well, you're on the right track. No, there's nothing to do with English now. I don't know how much English existed in this time. I assume in old English, but what does the word "na" mean in biblical Hebrew? What? That is not very common. Sometimes it means please. That's not the normal usage. What's the other meaning, the more common one? Well, how does the Targum always translate? Although it's hard to know if he always translates this way, even if it doesn't always mean this. Probably not. That's not what the... Anyone have a Targum here?
No.
Correct. Targum says Ke'enes. What does Ke'enes mean? No.
So you guys could have been biblical Parshanim. Wow. Hebrew Ta'is.
Nun Salah. You know the missing Nun?
No, I figured that if I'm going to be saying please give me some serious, you can't give me some serious now.
No, it doesn't mean Asa never said please. I'm sure sometimes he did. That was before he was old and gruff, grubbing for a bracha. Okay. Well, I guess somebody didn't like this. Is everybody
enough?
The laws of us turn to the three. We'll get your slightly waterlogged copy. Okay? At least here I can say, as valuable as it is, it's not Kodesh. Thank you very much. Now, if I spill again, I think I have just about enough. But there, okay. So how did Kenneth get to Kenneth? It doesn't look like it's missing in case, but how do you say his time? Be-i-to. There's a dagesh there. That doesn't show up in this form. Ns is a nun in there. Okay. So what does Ibn Ezra mean? Now, those who say al-kohum menu na. Na is not an adjective, it's an adverb. Don't eat it nowly. What does nowly mean? Like it is now. Right now, what was it? The hamer was still alive, it was raw. Right? So al-kohum menu na. In fact, it's turning it from an adjective. Basar na would be raw meat. But if na meant raw. But na doesn't mean raw, at least until we know the Arabic. So instead, al-kohum menu na. Don't eat it nowly. Right, nowly, in a now-like fashion, in a rustic. Okay, so that's basically context-driving interpretation. You've never gotten that out, you know. It doesn't mean, don't eat from it, please. Okay, right. Don't rush, right? Not yet. You guys want to eat from it? No. But anyway, he says, Ubederach hazos lo matana b'chol ha-mikra means you never find no used as an adverb. Right? No is really sort of I don't know what part of speech that would be. I mean, it is an adverb, but it's a different kind of adverb. I guess it's just more an adverb the other way than an adjective. Nailed it, or whatever. Okay. And anyway, that's the Rishonim using language. I don't think the Rishonim were shy about that. The fact is that it's obvious looking at Arabic and Hebrew and even looking at other languages that they're very useful. Now, a couple of comments about languages, and then I'll move on from that. Firstly, the most important languages for studying Biblical Hebrew, probably the single most important language is Ugaritic. Second to it, because we have much larger vocabulary, but not as close in terms of the family Semitic languages, is Akkadian or Babylonian. It's the same language. You see Akkad in Parshas Noach is one of the names. That's at least the origin of the word. Akkadian itself is a Semitic language, although it contains material from a non-Semitic language known as Sumerian. Okay. Other languages, well, we don't have very much in the way, aside from Arabic, we don't have that much material from other Semitic languages that would be useful, because we don't know much about them. It's basically, there's one other language that's obvious, but, you know, what's the other obvious Semitic language that's useful for Hebrew? Aramaic. Right? It sort of goes without saying, you're part of Tanakh and Aramaic. Obviously, one of the things you have to learn is the letters that switch between Hebrew and Aramaic. There are common switches, there are rare switches. Perhaps one of my favorite examples is the word for Eretz. I just saw there's an Agadah. I don't know where it is. I was reading with my son the Legends of the Bible. And one of the seven Earths is called Arka. You know what Arka is? Aleph, Resh, Kuf, Aleph. So this is where, in order to understand the Medrash, you immediately have to know some Tanakh. What?
The name of seven Earths. There's seven heavens and seven Earths. Arka. It's a very rare switch. Well, that's correct. There's one pasuk in Yirmiyahu, which is an Aramaic, which contains both. It says, I think, Kidain Talmud Lahon, Eloh, thus you should say to them, Elohaya, Vishmaya, Ara, Loahadu, the God that had not created heavens and earth, Yevadu, Vishmaya Arka Loahadu, Yevadu Me'ara Umikoshmaya Ela. They should be destroyed from underneath the heavens and the earth. One of them is Ara and one of them is Arka. So that is not a common switch, but I'll just pick the radical example. The more common switch with Ayin is, what's the Hebrew?
Sadi.
Sadi Ayin is a very common switch. This is a weird case because there are switches of Aleph and Ayin. What is the word for eights in Aramaic? Yeah. And funny things have happened here. The Aleph and Ayin switch. The Ayin has turned into an Aleph, but the Sadi has turned into an Ayin. An unusual phenomenon. One other example, which is, what is the Shiv Mirah? Does anyone know? What is the word to mean? What is Shiv Mirah mean? Yeah, that's what you would have all thought, right?
Rot.
No, it's nothing to do with bad.
What's
that? Lying.
Sorry?
Lying? No. Someone said, you know, lying down from bed. Now, Shiv Mirah means lying with illness. There's an expression used to refer to the chachamim as being sickly, katsire umarigi. The mem is part of the group. There is an old Aramaic inscription from, I think, Helban, the 10th century, where you get the expression in the context of sickness with the root mem resh kof. And this I heard, I don't know if it was his own or someone, Professor Bernstein quoted his father, Rebecca Bernstein's in Chalei Brachah, who suggested, does anyone know where mem resh tzadi appears in Tanakh? And it's a word that appears only once. V'hu kilalani kalan nimretes. What is a kalan nimretes? We don't know. But it probably means a sickening curse. Okay? Because ayin kuf and tzadi once again said it. The normal switch is ayin and tzadi. That's the common one.
Where's the retes?
What's that? Where? It's a David referring to Shimi when he's giving telling Shlomo to make sure you find the way to kill it. So it's a Malachim Aleph Parakeis. And towards the beginning of the parakeis, probably.
Actually, but I don't know if it helps at all. But in Arabic today, the switch between the ka sound and the a sound is very common. The Palestinians don't in the.
No, you missed my comments about. Well, let's say finish.
The Iraqis say the kosh sound, but the Israelis say, but the Palestinians leave it out. They instead of wherever it's called, they just say up.
Okay, I don't know. There are two ions, remember, so be careful that it's not, that's a different switch. The Rhein and the Ayin, that's how you get Gaza and Aza. I think I spoke about that here already now, so I'm not going about it again. But anyways, I don't know if that's the same thing or if you're really referring to something different. But okay, anyway, so bottom line is we do have such a switch. Be aware of it. What is the best source for language? I'm already dated here, but there is a newer dictionary. But when you want to know what a word means in Biblical Hebrew, where do you look? A dictionary of Biblical Hebrew. What dictionaries are there? Well, the original dictionary that was used for most of the last century was Briggs, Driver, and Brown Lexicon. It does not have, I believe, the Ugaritic materials. Or does it? I don't think so. I think maybe they did update it. But I had the Akkadian materials. If you want the most up-to-date dictionary, you use, I think, Kohler, Baumgartner is the lexicon of Biblical Hebrew. Okay, it's a dictionary. You don't have, it's not a concordance. It's a dictionary. Yeah. Possible. Could be. That I can, it could very well be. Yeah, I don't know, but it sounds reasonable to me. Okay. Anyway, so language is an issue. Finally, another great example. So we've seen really literature, the realm of using the Sabaeans. We've seen language, Rashi and Ibn Ezra, and then what I call archaeology. The Ramban, and this is a great, I love this example because it demonstrates both the value of about the importance of archaeology and how archaeology can go wrong. Where is Kever Rachel? Well, let's talk about the Ramban. Before I answer that question, though, the Ramban on the word Kivras Aretz, the old Kivras Aretz Laho Efrasa. What is Kivras Aretz?
Sieve.
Yeah. Translate what's that? It's a measure of land. No, Aaron, you're right. You know Rashi. That's good. You know, lush in the land when the ground is whole. You know, like a sieve. I understand that. The point is, you read the pasuk and you know immediately Kivras Aretz means a measure of earth. It's got to mean a measure of earth. It doesn't have to. You could say it's the time. But the simple reading is not the Agada. That's not the Rashi, is not the Pshat. Ibn Achim says Kivras Aretz means a great amount of land. Okay? And then Rashi goes on to quote, the Ramban quotes, first he quotes Menachem, and then he quotes the Radak, that is a different meaning, so it's a certain period of the day. He quotes this. Look at the third paragraph. After Hanachem, okay? Zechasat Yitzchir, it doesn't look like being a paragraph, but it is. It looks like the second paragraph, the third line. Zechasat Yitzchir, the Ba'ashra Shazachisi Ubasi Anili Rushalayim. It's not a great distance. It's not in the middle apart, so it couldn't be like Menachem. It couldn't be like the Radak. Goes on to make certain comments about the language. Okay, then he writes, go to the next paragraph.
Okay? Now, why did the Ramban think that the Kever should be in the Rama? Kol Barama Nishma. Now, there's a more important piece of evidence which makes this very difficult, which he doesn't quote. Now, how did the Ramban know where Kever Racha was? Correct. Or the locals. Now, it happens to be, now, granted, there is a Tosefta which in Sanhedrin, which makes the claim that Kever Rachel is approximately where it is today, even if it's not exact. Pshuto Shemikra is not Kever Rachel. And there are different days of Chazal, but it's pretty clear. Where is Kever Rachel? I'm sorry, I know that may create problems for people's politics. It really has no relevance. Because it doesn't matter, because the fight really is not about whether you're defending Kever Rachel or not. Whether you think you should or shouldn't is a separate question. It doesn't really matter whether Rachel is buried there or something, or as I might argue in my more facetious moments, that the bones of a donkey are buried there. And Rachel Imenu, HaKadosha, is buried somewhere in Nachlas Binyamin. And how do I know, why do I insist that Rachel is buried in Nachlas Binyamin? Yes, Jeremy? Because in Sefer Shmuel Aleph, in Perek Chesetes, Shmuel tells Shaul, after he has just anointed him, it's Perek Yud, it looks like. He tells as follows. He says, now don't forget about the donkeys, right? You were chasing after the donkeys, your father's going to worry. So he tells him as follows. You're going to go, you're going to meet some people. He says, when you leave me today, you will find two men. You'll find them next to Kever Rachel. In the territory of Binyamin, and Tzeltzach, I assume they identify some city in the area of Binyamin today, it says, Bigvul Binyamin. And they're going to tell you, the donkeys were found, now your father's worried about you. Right? It's very clear that the Tosefta Sanhedrin tries to make a resolution between this and the Pasuk and Chumash. Now, what do you do with the Pasuk and Chumash? The answer is there's no problem from the Pasuk and Chumash, there's no Sphira. The Pasuk and Chumash doesn't say that she was buried in Beis Lechem. Clearly, Menachem and Menachem certainly didn't understand it that way. I mean, how did he read it? V'ekbereh Hashem v'derech Ephras ki Beis Lachem. What is Beis Lachem? Ephras is Beis Lachem. Where was Rachel buried? Derech Ephras. What's Derech Ephras? It's the highway that led to or through Ephra. There's no steer at all. The Pasuk in Shmuel is very clear that the Kever is in Binyamin. Now again, from a political perspective, it's irrelevant, because once in the popular imagination that way, you're fighting over whether you should or shouldn't, and whether it's worth it or not worth it. You're fighting over a symbol and legitimacy, not over whether or not the bones of Rachel Imenu. But the bones of Rachel Imenu probably sit, I don't know where, actually where Nachlas Binyamin is, whether that's, you know, Yudah Shomron, or it's in or in the parts that of Eretz Yisrael that were, you know, even maybe now before 1967. But bottom line is that the bones of Rachel are probably not buried in Kever Rachel. Okay, whoever's buried there. I guess that's some type of business, of course, I'm not sure what it is. Anyway, so the Ramban in fact is probably wrong, but notice he revised his Teirush in light of what? I mean, crude archaeology we would call it, right? He comes there and says, oh, one second, he thought that was Kever Rachel, okay, maybe it is, but he thought it was Kever Rachel, he says, that shot can't be that way. And that's obviously, again, a valuable tool. You also see sort of two layers, the Ramban went back and obviously amended his Teirush. Okay.
No, this is, I don't know, theological,
I don't know how often you come up with such significant, it's not going to reorient your whole world orientation, it will just help you understand a pshat and a pasuk better, right? One other example that Eichler quotes, I mean, then everything I wanted to do today, one other example that Eichler quotes, I thought a few minutes, okay. In his article, and I mean, when I learned Tanakh, I didn't realize what this was, but if you look in Sefer, I think it's in Malachim or in Yirmiyahu, when Yoshiyahu was killed, it's got to be in Malachim, it can't be. It's in Malachim or Devar Yamin. And when Yoshiyahu was killed, what happens? Yoshiyahu was the last righteous king of Yehuda. He was Chizkiyahu's great grandson. I'm sorry? That's right. The tradition in the Medrash about the 300 arrows, right? Vayoruha morim el amelach Yoshiyahu. So that's the story is really in Divrei HaYamim, although it's partially Malachim, and it's described as the events when it says Biyamav Allah Paronecho Melech Mitzrayim, okay, and it's something like the expression Hilachem Al, not Hilachem Al Melech Ashur, Allah Al Melech Ashur. So when I learned that pasuk on my own, I assumed that it was still at a time when Assyria and Egypt were fighting with each other. And Yoshio stuck his head in between and got killed in the process. Eichler points out in the article it's not true. Now, Al is ambiguous there technically. He may have gone up to join the king of Ashur, because that was already at a time that Ashur was in decline, and which major power was on the rise? Babel. They were going to fight against, I don't think it was Nuchanetzar, I think it was Nuchanetzar's predecessor, his father, I don't remember who it was. But it's clear from the evidence, it doesn't contradict the Pasuk in Tanakh. It simply confirms it, but instead what it's doing is it's telling you how to read the Pasuk. In other words, at that point, it wasn't Ashur versus Egypt, it was Ashur plus Egypt versus Babel. And you wouldn't know that without having another reference. Otherwise, you're just going to be left technically with an ambiguity. So some of the Rishonim may have resolved it one way, but it is clear that if they had known the archaeological evidence, they just would have read the Pasuk the other way. Yeah. Comment? No. Ayol? So I would only frame it this way. I'm not aware of cases where there's really a direct contradiction. Let me put it this way. You don't, since the accounts in Malachim, leaving the Middle West aside, you know, certainly on the parts from, firstly, how do we have such information? We only have information when we have the annals of the Assyrian kings or things like that. So we don't typically have so much information. We have information what's going on outside. The picture, if you read, what's his name's books? Kenneth Kitchen, who's a former, he's a good firm Protestant archaeologist. You can read his stuff. And if you want to read archaeology, that's who you read. Okay? I mean, he's not the only one, but he's someone to read. There's also a book by, I forget his last name, is Hoffmeyer on Israel and Egypt, which I could recommend for reading. But one of the things they do, and this I think is very hard to contradict, this is really factual, is they lay out all the markers we have, and this is mostly later bias research, not earlier bias research, but all the information we have basically concurs with the biblical account in terms of the chronology and the basic events. You don't expect that to be contradicted unless Malachim was completely made up, which it's not. So that you're not going to find. The problems of archaeology tend to be much more inferential rather than explicit contradiction. So there, you know, so there already, it's going to depend on who the author is writing. If you get, you know, an archaeologist who is, you know, not from Jew or from Protestant, so he's going to be adopting one line. You get, you know, the archaeologist, and there are some real archaeologists, you know, it wasn't always this way, you know, who aren't as big as skeptics. It's a larger area, but if you want something to read, you can read their works. But I think that the kind of case you're asking about, where I don't know of cases that really come up in such a fashion where you can say a contradiction. But in this particular case, it's not a question of confirming and contradicting. It helps you understand what the Pasuk and Tanakh actually meant. Okay, a couple of last observations. I mentioned the seal business, right? Although I have to say, I was thinking about Pshuto Shemikra. Someone always asked me the question. It's a good question, but it may just be idiom. Why does she have to single? If the seal really means the string on which the cylinder seal is hanging, why does she need to mention that? Just give me the cylinder seal. Obviously, he gives her the string as well. That's a question. I'm not a compelling question, but it did occur to me, just from a literary perspective, garments play a major role in Parashat Vayeshev. You notice it's Yosef Ksonas Apasim. You notice Yosef also has to leave his garment with Beishas Potiphar. And I don't think that's a coincidence. And it would be very interesting, and it's well known, you can read Robert Alter's The Art of Biblical Narrative on the stories in Vayeshev, which the biblical critics is one of the, I think, silliest writers ever brought, but they didn't appreciate literary studies. The point to Parshas Vayeshev is going back and forth, which of course is deliberate. It's not a mark of different sources. But anyway, so I think wouldn't it be an interesting coincidence if Yehuda also left his garment with Tamar, like Rashi said? I'm not willing to go that far, but it'd be very interesting. It'd be very interesting. Now, one very important caution. Before I, in 1 or 2 minutes, speak about Akkadian Ugaritic, and next week we're going to look at both the laws that you're going to prepare and in some of the narrative material. Scholars often, you know, the question is, how do you read archaeological evidence? So once upon a time, scholars always tried to read archaeological evidence in light of the biblical account, which we generally like, but you have to be careful. You know, you have to treat the archaeological evidence as independent. You can't automatically read it in light of the biblical text. I think it's good to keep the biblical text in mind, but you know, there are limitations. Anyway, there were some very famous examples of where, especially when you had texts which were hard to decipher, where a letter or two was visible and the rest wasn't, where archaeologists started to read in things like from the Torah. So there was a very famous case of slaughtering a goat in milk, which, of course, half the letters weren't really there, but of course, when you see half the letters there and you in your mind fancifully reconstruct other letters, you say, ah, vasher b'chalav, lo sfashel yubi b'chalav imo. You have to be very careful about those things. Sometimes a goat is just a goat. Okay, and that's the way it is. And there's nothing to do with something written in the Torah. The two major languages we're going to deal with are Akkadian, which was written in what type of script? Cuneiform. Not an alphabetic script, but a syllabic script. It's awfully difficult. When I studied Akkadian, we just did the transcriptions into, you know, English characters of the syllables, because we spent a little time reading glyphs. Cuneiform symbols. What's that? I was in graduate school. It may be occasionally given in Revel here, but the truth is there are over 500 and growing different syllabic symbols in Akkadian, because when you have letters, the great advance of an alphabet is that you have a very limited number of letters that you use. When you don't have that, you have many more symbols. Again, someone who knows it knows the language, but if you don't, it gets much harder. There are very interesting, anyone's interested, email me and I'll send you the story of the decipherment, how they deciphered cuneiform. Remember, no one found a cuneiform German dictionary. No Akkadian. Now the best dictionary of Akkadian is in German. It's called the. I don't know if they finished the Chicago dictionary, but the original dictionary that's used that has everything in it is in German. But originally, they didn't discover, the archaeologists didn't find a German Akkadian dictionary. They found only Akkadian. But how did they decipher? It's an interesting story. Some of these linguists are very bright people. A Ugaritic is a language much closer to Hebrew. It has more consonants. It's more like Arabic. It has three vowels also, three different alephs, for three different vowels, A, an E, and an U. But it is alphabetic. However, it's written with wedge-like symbols. Now, the cuneiform is wedge-like because they used clay tablets when they were moist, and they used a wedge to make the symbols, and then they bake them. That's why they survived. Ugaritic was deciphered much more quickly. It was discovered in 1929, I think. It only took a couple years to decipher, and the reason for that is that they found a lexicon. They found literally, I think it was four, I don't know all four languages. They found, I think, four languages. One was Akkadian, which at that point they knew already. Ugaritic. I think Hurrian, which is a non-Semitic language, and I think what the fourth language was. But that made it much faster. Most Akkadian, we have literary stuff. We also have a lot of legal documents, a lot of common documents of commerce. Ugaritic we have, but the great Ugaritic finds were actually the Canaanite myths, as we call them, of the various gods and their battles and so on, which prove often illuminating for a lot of non-legal passages in Tanakh. And we're going to talk about both those issues next time. Are there any questions? Okay.